I don't know what's real. I don't know what's not real.
Limited Capacity is a collection of six darkly amusing stories about the mysterious ways we interact with the internet and with each other.
There's something going on with him. It's like an act. I don't trust him.
What?
You're staring at me like I should say something, but I don't really know what to do here.
That's the whole name of the game. Don't talk about how the town isn't real. Do you understand?
Limited Capacity. Available now on CBC Listen or wherever you get your podcasts.
This is a CBC podcast.
Welcome back, folks. Oh my God, I'm so excited to throw you to this week's episode. We had the absolute pleasure of sitting down with our new friend, Isabel, all the way over from London. And you know when you sit down, you meet someone and you have a conversation with them and you immediately just fall in love with them? That's Isabel. Just the most charming, sweet human you've ever met. Brian and I got to have a long chat with Isabel about her experience with living with, here we go, I'm going to try this, myalgic encephalomyelitis. Not bad. Also known as chronic fatigue syndrome. And holy shit, what a wild story. Isabel, also, you might have seen her before. Her TikTok's kind of blowing up. And her whole TikTok is all about just educating people about accessibility or the lack of accessibility in London. So I hope you enjoy this as much as Brian and I did. We love Isabel. We think she's the absolute sweetest. And no wrap up today. So just a nice, long, meaty chat. And we'll be back with our regular scheduled programming next week. Hope you enjoy. Later. Today, we are joined by Isabel, a vibrant young woman who is living her best life in London. And Isabel's life took a bit of an unexpected turn at age 9 when illness struck, leading to a chronically fluctuating health journey, which we're going to dive into in depth, I'm sure. And so today we're going to be getting into her story and how she's using social media to combat ableism in the big city. Isabel, thank you so much for joining us today. So excited to see you, to meet you, to talk to you. Please take a moment, introduce yourself to the two of us and to our listeners.
Well, I like my introduction. Thank you very much. That's very kind. That's actually the second time this week I have been referred to as young. Not to say that I'm old, but I think I'm in the sort of middle territory. So, you know, any snippets from young, I'm grateful to take. So I am in my mid-30s in London, and I would say even though I had a period of being well before 9, I kind of don't have too many memories from that time. So I would say the life that I live today is very much like molded it to fit around my illness, which I've had years where I've been like very well and lived like a sort of normal life. And then I've had years where I've lived an extremely abnormal life. And it's just sort of, it's a real, you know, as Ronan Keating once said, life is a roller coaster, assuming that Ronan made it to Canada. I don't know if that's going to land.
that saying does go here.
It crosses borders for sure.
Pretty sure that's an international saying.
Yeah.
If I'm going to be honest, we do hear that here, but more so than that, we hear life is a highway. I'm going to ride it all night long. But
I've never heard that.
Yeah, that's well.
It is.
Yeah, I mean, and it really is. You know, we're just on this ride all night long.
This trans-Canadian highway, if you will. Isabel, I'm curious to. You said that you can't really remember much before you were 9 years old. I'm just wondering, do you have many memories of being 9 years old and what happened to you in your health when you were 9?
Yeah, I do. So I kind of like broadly, I remember before I became unwell, I was like very, very sporty. I would say like that I wanted to be a women's footballer. I obviously had no chance. That was a bit of a fantasy. And it was, you know, it was right that I woke up, but, you know, it really did sort of, that dream did come crashing down. I think, yeah, I guess like day to day, I can remember what life was like before I became unwell, and it was almost like a total shift. So like, I guess I had that like carefree, happy childhood where I was like running around and could do what I wanted. And then, boom, I became unwell, and then I sort of like couldn't really get out of bed. And so, yeah, it was a bit like a sort of switch flicked. But that feels like so long ago now. Like I think for a long period after I became ill, when people ask me like, oh, what are your hobbies? I would still want to say what they were before I was unwell, because I thought, I don't want to be judged on what I can do now. I want people to know that I was like really good at football. Well, I wasn't really good, but you know, that I was like, you know, did all this stuff. But now I've sort of like, you know, I don't like to mention that sort of thing now, because it just doesn't really feel like me or the person that I've evolved into. I'm now a very stationary person.
Well, so what was it that happened with your health when you were 9 years old?
So initially I sort of had like a virus, nothing like hugely alarming, but then it sort of was one in a long line of sort of like various like infections and illnesses. I just kept getting sort of like one thing after another. And then I just sort of didn't recover. And then I, about sort of a year after being like very unwell, I got a diagnosis of ME, or chronic fatigue syndrome, which did fit. I do think that that was like, I was quite lucky to get a diagnosis back then, because this is like 1998, which is in the grand scheme of things, a very long time ago. And considering how people are still a bit confused by those sorts of like, kind of like long fatigue heavy illnesses, I think looking back, it's like, okay, well, I, you know, at least I got a diagnosis. And then further down the track, sort of more recently, I've been diagnosed with POTS, and I don't know if that was always the case, or if I have both, or if it changed, or I never had ME and I've always had POTS, or like, are they part of the same world? Like, I honestly don't know. But now if someone said, what's wrong with you? I would say, well, where do we start? Well, I'd say in terms of like medically, I would say POTS, because I feel like that is the easiest to describe. And I think it covers most of my major difficulties that I have day to day.
So, well, to that point, can you describe POTS for us? I've heard the term, but I don't think I can remember what
it is. I believe
we've
spoken about POTS on the show before,
So it stands for postural orthostatic tachycardia syndrome, which I understand, you know, doesn't mean loads as words, but how that looks is essentially it's a condition that affects the autonomic system, and the autonomic system controls all the things that your body should do like automatically. So like your heart rate, your blood pressure, your like temperature control, your digestion, sort of all the things like that that you shouldn't really have to think about. Like, it's sort of, I guess, like the cruise control settings is what I like to call them. But when you have POTS, and like a big issue is when you're standing up. So when I stand up, my heart rate just gets higher and higher and higher, and my blood pressure gets lower and lower. So if I was to stand, I'm basically like a bit of a ticking time bomb, as in if I continue to stand, I would eventually just pass out. I just become more and more unwell. And all my blood like pools into my legs. So if I sit, my legs will go like purple. Just anything that's like sort of, you know, hanging down will go like, I guess, full of blood. And my heart will try to pump it around, to pump it back up. So it, that creates the tachycardia. So it's a real nightmare when I stand. So I sort of am very limited. It's almost like if I, so I use a wheelchair when I leave the house because I can't stand up long enough to get out the house without one. But around the flat, it's a small flat, and I just sort of like shuffle from chair to chair. But like in a scenario where like the postman's taking ages to like rummage in his bag, I'm like, oh God, starting to sweat. So I have like a chair by the door so that, you know, I don't leave the, I would hate to start a postman's day with having to deal with me sort of like a heap on the floor. I think that would
be falling into their arms as they're trying to grab your bills from the sack.
How do you do things like, I'm just really curious of this, like being in your house and trying to do, you know, like medial tasks, like washing the dishes or like doing laundry, things where you're like standing by, you know, something, whether it's an appliance or a countertop, like how do you navigate doing those things in your home?
So in terms of,
she gets the postman to do it.
Yeah. While you're here.
Yeah. Of course. What a stupid question.
Yeah. Honestly, like, a lot of that stuff I don't do. So I'm very fortunate that I live with my wonderful girlfriend who does do a lot of the like chores like that sort of thing. And when I lived on my own a couple of years ago, I paid for a carer to like come and do that sort of thing for me, which was really expensive, but it did kind of allow me to have the independence that I sort of wanted and needed. But like in terms of like the things that I still do, so like cooking, I can't really stand over a hob. I can't really stand anyway, but like I sit and I cook, or like I'll sit and chop. But in terms of like cooking something, the heat makes me worse. So I just have to, if I am going to cook, I have to just shove things in the oven and then just like leave it and hope for the best. So like I have found like ways around it. We have a dishwasher, which, you know, is an asset to any household. And like, yeah, washing, if I did hang washing out, I just like have to just chuck it at the thing. I can't be like faffing about, because I guess like also like potentially I could do that sort of thing, but then I probably can't leave the house for 2 weeks to do anything else. So it's about like allocating my energy to like in the most effective way.
For our Canadian, our, you know, our North American listeners, a hob is basically an oven or like a stovetop.
Okay.
Unless I totally fucked that up, but that's...
No, you
that's,
are correct.
Woohoo!
Okay. Calvin and Hobbes, the comic, is Calvin and an oven.
Calvin and his and anthropomorphic oven that looks like a tiger.
Okay, that makes sense.
I just to like kind of throw this back to some of the stuff that we've covered there. So when it comes to pots, for the people who are looking for like a more nerdy sort of description. So POTS, and this is kind of interesting. So POTS is one of a group of disorders that have a orthostatic intolerance as their primary symptom. And so what I'm gathering is that orthostatic intolerance touches on what you were mentioning there, which is essentially excessively reduces the volume of blood that returns to the heart after an individual either, you know, stands up from a lying down position, essentially. So that pooling, the blood pools down and the heart's like trying to get it back up into the heart, but it just doesn't have that oomph to get enough of that blood up. Which like obviously that would fuck up anybody who's struggling with it. But to come back to the ME or the chronic fatigue syndrome.
What's ME?
Okay, I'm gonna try this. Myalgic encephalomyelitis. Fuck. What do you know?
I'm not in a position to correct you, unfortunately, because I can't say it either. I could probably like read it, but I just can't retain it. Doesn't stick.
It's too many letters in one word. Yeah. Encephalomyelitis. Got it. Fucking, that's it for sure.
You just have to say them fast. Encephalomyelitis.
I know.
But, it's a bit like a word that like a cat's walked across keyboard.
Yeah, that's it. So I would love to touch on the chronic fatigue syndrome. And the reason for that is because I know we've probably had quite a few people that have applied to be on the show in the past that have chronic fatigue. And we've never had an opportunity to have a conversation with someone who lives with it. Or at least, you know, not to our knowledge. Maybe we've had somebody on there where it was like a comorbidity or something, but we never really took a deep dive into it. And the reason why I kind of want to just unpack this a little bit is because, correct me if I'm wrong, Isabel, but, I feel like for the vast majority of folks, when they hear chronic fatigue syndrome, there's oftentimes a preconceived notion that that is like a sort of a name of an illness that's sort of, you know, perhaps like thought of as like made up or like, you know, not really. It's like, is that really like
we couldn't really properly diagnose you with something. And right. We just like know that you're chronically fatigued.
So we'll just give it like, we'll just give it some sort of, you know, catch all name. And it's not really based in any deep science. It's more so just a sort of like, you know, it's like the chronic Lyme sort of debate where it's like, is chronic Lyme really a thing or is it something that we just don't know what it is? And so we just call it chronic Lyme. But
that's the perception that you're saying.
I'm saying, I feel like I'm going to say, I feel like there was a perception of that, but now after, you know, off the heels of COVID, where we are now seeing a very large influx of people experiencing post-viral illnesses that have come from COVID. And a lot of these people are experiencing something very similar to, if not exactly, CFS. I feel like the narrative and the understanding maybe is shifting a little bit, you know, in a very positive way. But I do want to just state for folks that aren't aware, the Center for Disease Control and Prevention, they state specifically that chronic fatigue syndrome is a serious long-term illness that affects many body systems. People with CFS are often not able to do their usual activities. At times, it may confine them to a bed, and people with CFS have severe fatigue and sleep problems. So all that to say, Isabel, you know, from 9 to, you know, now, when you say chronic fatigue syndrome, when you are, you know, explaining to someone what you might be experiencing, what have, you know, in general, what have the sort of reactions been, or what is the sort of general understanding that you have taken from someone who actually lives with it, that the general population sort of views chronic fatigue syndrome?
So obviously there's a huge spectrum of responses, you know, when you slap down chronic fatigue syndrome, but I would say like, in the early days when I was sort of like getting a lay of the land of like how people are going to respond, I think very, very quickly, I conditioned myself to like sort of really recoil? Is that the word?
Recoil, yeah.
Because like it was so often met by like skepticism, people giving like unsolicited sort of advice, which isn't like, oh, like here's this magical potion. It was like, go for a walk around the garden, you'll feel better. That sort of thing, which is like really, really ignorant. And as a child, I didn't have the confidence to sort of like take people on that were saying that sort of thing to me. I think like sort of in terms of like medical professionals, and initially when I went to the doctor, I wasn't believed. They just thought I like didn't want to go to school. And I was always very like sociable. I really loved school. I really loved doing things. And I think people really quickly want to put you in a box of being like lazy, and just like not wanting to like, you know, contribute to society, which is like really frustrating. In fact, I think when you can't contribute to society, whether that is like running around the garden or whether that is like working, I think it, like people have no idea how that feels. So to suggest that somebody has like chosen that path, I think is just like really, really hard to deal with. I think also I remember being really shocked. You know how people like to say, oh, you know, if you sort of change your attitude, if you like cheer up or if you think positively, you'll get better. I remember being like shocked within myself that that does not work because I've always been quite positive. And I remember like surprising myself, like, fuck, it actually doesn't work. Like you can't smile your way out of a chronic illness. And I think like, yeah, like throughout every stage of my life, I've had people not want to take the time to understand. I think when people ask you, and I can understand to a degree because like when you present a sort of like mystery, of course, people are going to have questions and I don't have the answers to them and doctors don't have the answers to them either. So they can't explain why these sort of things happen. And I think naturally, obviously, I can't speak for everyone, but there's a lot of people that naturally like to be like, oh, well, you know, it's nothing. Or, you know, like if someone's off work, be like, oh, they're probably skiving, or like, oh, they probably had a heavy night last night. I think that's quite a lot of people naturally want to sort of go down that road. So yeah, to be honest, throughout my whole life, I've sort of struggled with that to the point where I think that's really conditioned me to sort of be at a point where I was like fearful of telling people that I have a chronic illness, because I just was so like desperate to not be put into that box. But, you know, now I'm at a point where I'm just like, take it or leave it. You know, I'm physically fucked, but this is what I can do. If you don't want to believe that, do you know what? I don't really care. Because at the end of the day, them not believing me doesn't improve my situation. Right. It doesn't, like, them thinking that if I go for a walk around the garden, I'll improve. That doesn't actually work. Mm-hmm. I think when I was younger, I was a bit more vulnerable to trying these like crazy ideas that people had, like, oh, you should go and see this guy and he'll, you know, inject you with bee pollen. That isn't a true story, but I have like trialed some strange things that like I wouldn't do now because I was like so desperate. And I think the chronic illness community, in terms of like this, like people that have an illness that can't be explained, are like really, really vulnerable to these like things.
Yeah. It almost like perpetuates a desperation, you know, where it's like, I'll fucking do anything at this point. Like my life is so in shambles that, you know, like blow some bee pollen up my asshole. And like, if that works, I'll fucking do it. Like,
yeah.
And then well, also it's like, well, I can't say that it won't work. So maybe I need to try. And also I've always been really fearful of people thinking that I don't want to try. So like, I remember many years ago when I was a single lady and I was like dating, which was a real minefield, because obviously you have to sort of present these things about yourself. And you know, like dating is sort of like a bit of an audition in itself. Mm-hmm. And then people have their opinion and then, you know, whatever. I remember, so a big thing with, I think, Emmy and like certainly my situation is if I overexert myself, I become very, very unwell afterwards. So if I was to overexert myself, it might take me months to recover. And I remember dating this guy and him sort of saying, oh, you know, I think you need to go rollerblading. I can borrow some rollerblades from someone. And I remember being like, do you know what? That's not going to help me. And then him saying something like, well, you're not going to recover if you're not proactive. And then I had to be like, okay, sure, let's go rollerblading then. But we didn't. So obviously, you know, I did step in at some stage. But it's like things like that. Like you really, you feel like you're on borrowed time in people sort of not thinking negatively of you. So you think, oh, I've got no scope to sort of like fuck up here.
Yeah. I think I'd be more afraid of being judged for being a rollerblader than I would for being judged on my illness.
Yeah, I would say that really does not have a lot of sex appeal.
No.
And I think if I was to give him some unsolicited advice, I would say, let's just don't announce that immediately.
And also like rollerblading in London, like it's like cobblestone is not made for rollerblading.
Yeah, it's not Los Angeles.
Yeah.
I'm curious, Isabel, about your like experience and your relationship with your parents, particularly when you were 9 and then into your early teen years. I know that like our perception of the world is often influenced by the people closest to us, like our parents in those developmental years, and going through this experience, you know, the doctors are speaking to you, but they're also speaking to your parents, I'm guessing. And I'm sure that that has some sort of impact on how you perceive yourself and your experience with illness at that time. What was that experience like?
I would say I was like incredibly fortunate that my parents believed me and they could see for themselves like the switch that had happened. And obviously, I guess they'd known me for 9 years, so they had a general scope of like what I like doing. And I think so they did back me, but they received a lot of external pressure to like get me back to school. And I remember once like social services left a voicemail on the phone because they were sort of like you know, wanting to know why I wasn't at school, because I from 9 to 13, I had a lot of time off school when I went to school part-time. And then from 13, I like totally exited the education system. So mm-hmm. I think my parents were always very worried because at that time there was stories of like children being taken into care because they thought their parents were like keeping them out of school and like all this stuff. Basically the whole sort of like system, everyone was flailing. No one knew what it was. Everyone was just like confused and panic reacting. Yeah, I was really fortunate that my parents believed me because I'm sure that isn't the case, probably 50% of the time.
Can you give us a little bit of insight into what those years are like? So I know that like from 13 to 17, like, I mean, what you had wrote into us was like 13 to 17, absolutely fucked. laying in the dark, no education, left the house 3 or 4 times a year using a wheelchair. So like, you know, that's wild. And also that period of time, you know, it's like that's high school. That is one of the most like key times to develop social skills and relationships, yeah. You know, like core relationships. So like, what was that, you know, what were those 4 or 5 years? Like, what did that look like for you?
I would say like ultimately very boring. But I think like, do you know what? I never thought like if someone said, okay, off you go into your bedroom, you're going to be there for 5 years. I'd have been like, what? I'd have had a different reaction. But because I thought like, oh, next week I'm going to be like, oh, let's do that next week when I'm better. I think I had a bit of like, I still had a bit of like youthful naivety about my situation. And as much as the doctors couldn't tell me like how to get better or like what the future held for me, they couldn't say that I wasn't going to get better. So I was just like sort of counting down the days. And I think I just took it day by day. So I would just like, I would just listen to a lot of music. And I think, yeah, do you know what? It's all a bit of a daze that time. I think socially, I was very isolated. I had like a lot of phone calls with my friend who's still very much in my life now. We would speak like quite frequently, very frequently. And that was probably like my only social interaction that I had because back then it wasn't like laptops and mobile phones. It was like, can I get downstairs to like go on the modem with the really slow, you know, AOL chat rooms. yeah, it wasn't really like how it is today. So there wasn't that like, because I think I've been isolated in recent years where I haven't been able to get out and about, but it's been like totally different. I still felt very much included and like I can still have a lot of contact with my friends. But yeah, it was just like a, but I think I was so unwell that it was almost like time just disappeared. You know how like you, if you feel like really, really well, you would struggle to not get bored lying in bed all day. You would start to get a bit like fidgety by like 4 PM.
I mean, it's not unlike COVID, right? Like, I mean, you know, COVID, that two-year period, at least here in Canada, like where there was a lot of lockdowns and not a lot of people getting out of their house, like that period of time is, it feels like a blackout for me. Like it's, it just feels like that those 2 years didn't really exist. Even though there was lots of things happening and lots of things going on, it just feels like, it feels like
a blur.
It feels like that period, those 2 years of life were just kind of wiped from my memory. It's so fucking bizarre. So like, you know, in your situation of literally being locked down during a time where there was no pandemic, I can see how that would just be like, yeah, fuck, I don't know. It's a blur. Like it's really.
Yeah, for sure. I think, but yeah, because I just felt so unwell, time just sort of like disappeared and it was just about like getting through each day and like, yeah, I think my life was just very, very, very tiny in that. Hmm. Chapter.
I think of I like watching a lot of YouTube, and there's a channel that I've been subscribed to for years. It's called Physics Girl, and she's a science communicator, and she got either COVID or another viral infection a couple years ago, and has some sort of post viral illness, and has been diagnosed with CFS. And has just been incapacitated and like kind of went dark on the channel for a while, but then there started to be some posts that would come out, and it was her husband, you know, taking pictures of her in bed. And eventually there was another YouTuber who went in and sort of filmed a video going into her house and documenting the state of the situation. And you know, she still to this day is completely bedridden, like lays in the dark with, you know, a cold towel over her head, you know, most of the day. And I had a question that I wanted to ask you, but I'm also, the reason why I'm telling this story of this YouTuber is because, like, having that sort of point of reference of like how incapacitated and how tough and challenging this situation can be, but then wanting to ask this question to you of like, how do you do school at that time? And like, how do you learn? I'm wondering, like, was your situation where you were basically just essentially bedridden, similar to this situation that I described, or were you able to, you know, do things like try to do some sort of education and things like that?
No, I was pretty much bedridden, really. Like, I couldn't do anything, really. I think my main focus was like managing my symptoms, I guess, which is just like trying different things. I couldn't really tolerate reading because of my like headaches. I couldn't really have a lot of light most of the time because I was like very sensitive to like light and sound. I definitely couldn't have like written a thing. If I had to write a thing, I wouldn't have been able to write it.
This is why she sounds so stupid, Brian. She didn't have any education.
I think it's like one thing that I think, and until I had this point of reference of like watching this YouTuber go through this in this way that it was like documented from an outside perspective. I think it's really hard to wrap your head around what somebody who is going through this is experiencing. And, you know, like knowing that you said, as you said, like those 4 years were fucked.
Like absolutely fucked, I believe is exactly.
how does that person at 17 go to this person at, you know, in their mid 30s now that is like sitting here having a conversation with us? Like, what is that sort of progression that happens coming out of like being the 17-year-old version of yourself?
It's funny because obviously now if people looked at my life, external people looked at my life, they'd be like, cool, you've got a shit life. I don't know how you do it. You know, people would probably think that. But to me, I'm like, oh, you should have seen me, you know, as a teenager, because that really was shit. And it was shit. But I think, so I like, basically, I was very fortunate that I did begin to recover sort of around 17 and very, very, very slowly and a lot of sort of hard work and discipline, I would say. I just sort of began to tolerate building up my activity that I could do. And that was literally sort of like initially walking outside of the front door and doing like two steps, going back to bed. And then like the next week, it would be like three steps. So it was like so tiny that like, it's almost like, oh, why bother? It's like so tiny, like it's not going to make any difference, but it did make a difference. And I kept doing it. And then like fast forward a year, I was like walking down the road and then just like managing to like build myself up in every way. And then like once I sort of got wind that perhaps of like the possibility that I could live a life, I was like, right, let's go. And then I, but obviously I didn't have any qualifications or any like schooling, but luckily my skill set lies very much in arts, which is hard to quantify. You can't really take any, no one can tell you if you're good or shit. So I just really went down that road and fortunately, I got into art school where in well, just outside of London. So I like moved away, and it was all like, "Oh, am I going to be able to manage it? Oh, well, I'm going to have to just like go for it." And I like looking back, I don't know how the hell I was like so fearless, because like that is like to go from a tiny world that is a bedroom to like going to London and like living pretty much independently is like, you know, what a head fuck. But yeah. I don't know. I just sort of just went with it. I guess I thought like I've lost so many years. Now I have to just like go for it. And then, yeah, I just, that allowed me to get on the path to sort of getting an education. And then fast forward a few years and I got a BA, a Bachelor of Arts degree in graphic design.
Yeah. I'm curious.
It's no use to me now.
I'm curious about your ability to set boundaries. You kind of briefly touched on it when you were referencing dating and you know, having to say no to things you know, that other people are proposing to you. Setting boundaries is something that I really struggle with in my life. And I'm imagining, you know, with the consequences or stakes being so high for you, obviously, you know, setting boundaries is incredibly important. What have you learned yourself about setting boundaries?
So I think naturally I think I'm like a people pleaser. So I don't want to set boundaries. I want to please other people, but like slowly but surely. And, you know, back when I was like dating in my 20s, I like probably didn't push back enough, like 100% I didn't push back enough. However, now I'm definitely more in control. And, you know, if like a friend's coming over, also, I think I'm like very fortunate that the people that I spend time with are like all very, very close friends and like very understanding and wonderful. And so if I say, oh, like, I'd love to see you, but I can't get out, can you just come over for a bit? I can only probably do like an hour, or I can only do 2 hours. They're very respectful of that. But I'd like to think if I was in a situation where somebody didn't understand, I would still be able to like communicate, because I guess, yeah, there's a lot at stake. Like if I, want to be polite by sort of, if I feel like I can't leave a situation, then I like, they're not going to be thinking about how Isabel stayed for a really long time and that was really great in 3 weeks' time when I'm still like absolutely fucked and can't get out of bed.
Yeah.
And I think a big thing, and I think a big source of the misconception around like ME and like all of these like chronic illnesses is that, you know, people don't see you when you're really fucked because you're at home being fucked. It's like an invisible illness, but like if you have a invisible illness, quite often you're invisible because you're not out in society, you're like stuck at home. And I think that's why people can't get their head around it, because they can't see it. Whereas I think like, I mean, I've already said that I'm very fortunate that all my friends understand, but what I have found is that any friend that I've been on holiday with or like lived with totally get it, because they've seen it. They've seen the after effects of me like, you know, doing whatever. Whereas I think like, you know, if I sort of make a new friend and I'm still getting to know them, it takes them a while to like fully get it.
Are vegans actually unhealthy?
Does cannabis ruin your sleep?
And why are so many men taking testosterone supplements? I'm Mitch.
And I'm Greg.
And we're the creators of the popular YouTube channel ASAP Science.
Every week on our podcast Side Note by ASAP Science, we explain the science behind a controversial subject with recent research, up-to-date studies, and ridiculous stories so you are entertained while, bam, simultaneously learning.
We're here to make science make sense.
Download Side Note by ASAP Science wherever you get your podcasts.
I would love to move on to talking about accessibility, accessibility in London, you know, your views on accessibility, I'd love to just take a second to, just look at a TikTok that you have, that you've published. Your TikTok is, for those who are interested in checking it out, it's at Isabelle Welly, and the O is a zero. And, you know, a big part of your TikTok is just trying to spread awareness around issues pertaining to accessibility, in particular in London. As a wheelchair user, you know, we've talked about accessibility quite a bit on the podcast, especially with, you know, initiatives in cities like Toronto called Stop the Gap, where it's like, you know, you go down most city streets in Toronto, all of the shops, all of the restaurants, all the cafes, there's this, you know, this like 6-inch gap between the, you know, the sidewalk and the entrance to the building. And so there was this group of people that were going to all these buildings and just dropping these little ramps to like make those places accessible that typically aren't. And I know that you're, you know, through your TikTok, you're trying to spread that same sort of awareness. I want to just play a TikTok that I loved, which is of you getting onto a city bus.
There is nothing less discreet than getting onto the bus as a wheelchair user. It's really, really hard to achieve that sort of chic, mysterious woman, strong style type vibe when the bus is like announcing the ramp with the, you know, hooting and wailing. But look, I've just got to work with what I've got. This is actually the first time I've ever got the bus as a wheelchair user. I was sort of putting it off. I was thinking about that feeling when you run for the bus, but you don't make it. And then you have to sort of style it out and it feels embarrassing. I was thinking about that, but I'm like sat at the bus stop. The sirens are wailing. You know, the door's open. I'm sat there. And then people don't want to get out of the way. Or maybe there isn't space for me. Or maybe there's like a pram. Or maybe the ramp doesn't even come out and I've touched the dirty button for no reason. But look, there's only one way to get over it, and that's to do it. And maybe, look, it's 2024 now. Maybe it's time we normalized people breaking down publicly when they miss the bus. But yeah, it was all good. My girlfriend gave me a shove up the ramp, so I'm going to try one more time without her help before I can officially identify as a bus wanker. Bye.
Firstly, I want to say that sweet like support wheel on the back of your wheelchair. I don't think I've seen that before. What is that? That looks nifty. It also looks like it's got some tech in there, like a light and stuff. What's that all about?
It is nifty, actually. It's called a Smoov, S-M-O-O-V. And basically, so there's like a little control thing at the front of my wheelchair and it like clips on and it basically means that my wheelchair is like powered. So because my energy is basically like a bag of sand with a hole in, that allows me to sort of get out on my own. Whereas if I didn't have that, I would need someone to push me. So it is actually, yeah, it's a bit of a game changer, actually. It's a great bit of tech. Yeah.
I love that. That's so cool. I've never heard of it before. I'm just looking it up now. Smoov 1, the rear-mounted power assist system. That's so cool.
So
I love that.
So are you still like pushing and it's giving you extra power, sort of like, you know, like an electric bike might support pedaling?
So if I was to sort of turn it on and not touch anything, I would continue moving forward, but I have my hands on the wheels to like steer.
Okay.
Because there's like no sort of even pavements in London. So you do have to sort of constantly be steering, which is fine. I mean, it is actually a great bit of technology, and everybody that's given it a go has absolutely loved it.
Cool. Very cool.
In terms of accessibility in London, like what are some of the big challenges that the city faces?
I think it's a lack of awareness that places should be accessible. So like, I think a huge thing that could be solved really easily is that, say if I want to go somewhere and I just have a quick look online to see if the place is accessible, I can't find out. So I would have to like ring up and then I'm ringing a number that's like probably not even got a phone plugged into. So it's like really, really hard to find out if places are accessible, and you would think that they aren't saying they're accessible because they're probably not, but that isn't the case. Like, places just don't care. And I think that is one of my big motivations for doing the TikToks is I like really want people to have an awareness that aren't disabled, because obviously, of course, disabled people know how like crap it is and how far we have to go, how far there is to go to get to the place where we should be. But I really want people that aren't disabled to recognize it. And actually, a lot of things could be solved so easily that I just really, 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 really want people to start caring. And I think like on paper, I think the UK shows like it cares a bit. Like I saw something yesterday and it was saying about how like the government want the UK to be like the most accessible, or maybe it's London, the most accessible place in the world by, I can't remember what it is, like 2030 or something. And I was thinking like, that's great, I love that. But to me, that's like a child saying, I want to be an astronaut. And yeah, us right, being like, right, you're going to be an astronaut, but are you going to be an astronaut? I don't think that you are. I kind of think like there's so far to go. And I honestly don't get the vibe that people want to change. I think people want to tick the boxes if they have a gun to their head. But I don't think they actually, like, I think a lot of things, technically are accessible, but then you see like a accessible bathroom, like at the top of a slope, like things like that. It's like they've shoved it in, but it isn't actually that user friendly.
Yeah, just to check a box, like as opposed to actually thinking about it. Yeah.
Do you think that that part of it comes from a lack of understanding of what accessibility really means? And I think of this from the perspective of, you know, like you ring up a place and say, are you accessible? And the person says yes, because they're on like the first floor of a building, but like maybe they're not thinking of like the curb, the lack of like ramp to get up that 6-inch gap, like Jeremy was mentioning in Toronto. Is that part of the problem?
Yeah, I think so, 100%. I don't think people wake up and think, I want to exclude disabled people. But I think it's just like a sheer lack of knowledge. And I think like, I can't see that it's going to change until there's more like representation of disabled people. So people are more comfortable and don't freak out when they see a disabled person and say something weird. I think there needs to be like a lot more normalizing and more education so that people understand what that actually means. Like, I think it should be like mandatory for businesses. If you're going to have a space for the public, you should know, you know, what you need to do in order to like not exclude people. And I guess everybody's just fumbling around in the dark, and some places do an amazing job, but then they're still probably not aware of it. They're still not like putting it on their website. Not that it's all about putting it on a website, but I think it, again, it's about making it accessible. Like, I have limited capacity. I can not get out the house that frequently. So when I do go out, I don't want to have to go to like 5 bars before I can find a toilet. Yeah. It's like a waste of energy.
It is hard too, because like it has to be, I think that one of the points that you're making is like there has to be a systemic change. And just by announcing that you want to be like the most accessible city or the most accessible country isn't really like a clear enough goal in doing that. And one place that I've seen accessibility work is on the internet. So with web development, web pages get behind the scenes an accessibility score. And, you know, you can go to any website and right click in your browser and open up, like inspect the web page and run a Google Lighthouse report and see the accessibility score of that website. And the reason why I think this works is not just because there's a score for it, but web pages actually get demotivated and deranked. And, you know, if they're not SEO optimized, then it's harder for people to find them. And so because there's this sort of systemic understanding or higher level understanding that like this needs to be a priority, and we start to promote places that are doing it well, then it incentivizes everybody to do it. And, you know, accessibility doesn't have to be just about, you know, supporting disabled people, but oftentimes accessible design is just good design in general. And so there's benefits to everybody. Like when we talk about and not to like go too deep into like the web development side of things, but it's interesting from my perspective, because, you know, like accessible design is not just about whether images have alt text so that people using screen readers can read them, but it's also about, you know, implementing good contrast ratios so aesthetically it's more pleasing and it's easier for even a person, you know, who has 20/20 vision to have a more positive viewing experience. So
the part that's tough though is like, I mean, you know, that makes sense for web development, and the thing about that sort of side of tech is that implementing those changes is very quick in comparison to like I was in Portugal this summer, and man, Portugal, that place has been there for a fucking long time. And that's that city, in Lisbon, was built on 7 gigantic motherfucking hills. And, you know, it's like in order to make that city, if you wanted to make Lisbon the most accessible city in Europe, you would have to level the whole fucking city and start over from scratch, because the infrastructure of this place that has been there for fucking ever is not, you know, it was not built with wheelchair users in mind, because there was no such thing at the time. And so it's like, even London, like I think about any, like, you know, here in Canada, or, you know, in North America, I would say it's probably a little bit easier to implement modes of accessibility than it would be to cities in Europe that have existed for, you know, much, much longer than any city here in Canada.
Which just proves the point, though, even more that, like, you know, if Lisbon was going to become more accessible and, you know, the government said nobody is going to get government subsidies, nobody's mm-hmm. going to get government funding or support unless they level the fucking city, then people would just be forced to have to do it. And even though it is difficult and very hard, mm-hmm. until the higher ups say, this is like, this has to be status quo, otherwise you're not going to get our support, then yeah. I don't think that that change will happen as quickly.
No, yeah. Yeah, my point was just like
it's hard.
The innovation, the innovation when we're talking about the infrastructure of a city has to be so much more intense and great than the innovation needed to develop accessibility for, you know, anything that exists on the web or, you know, video games or what have you, whatever mm-hmm. it is, anything that's like tech, just the innovation has to be like through the roof. But, you know, and in a city, like, you know, in general, like when you look at London, like how accessible does London feel to you right now on paper? If you were going to like, you know, compare it to other places you've been, I don't know if you've traveled much, but, if you've been elsewhere, like how does London stack up?
Well, in the grand scheme of things, I do think London is pretty good. I think certainly around the UK, it's like, if I was to compare like smaller towns and like London, like I think it's probably better. But I guess, because I think the things that are being built sort of in recent years, they typically are accessible, which is great. But then there's places like very old buildings and stuff like in Soho, like mm-hmm. no way am I going to be able to find a disabled toilet around there unless it's like a very new shiny building. But I think like, I guess like maybe the UK is going to be the most accessible like place in the world. And that says more about how inaccessible other places are. But I think it's hard because I haven't really traveled since I've been using a wheelchair. I've been to Lisbon actually, but I didn't really leave the hotel. So
What the fuck are you going to do in Lisbon?
Yeah.
And if you are going to leave the hotel, it's like, there's one spot you can leave and it's like the most debaucherous, like university, just like batshit crazy fucking area, you know? Anyway, sorry, I could go on forever.
But I think like cobbles and things like that do make life a bit difficult. But totally. I mean, I guess like, you know, I'm probably coming from a huge place of privilege, the fact that I live in London and public transport is accessible to a degree, but like my local tube station, so I live near an overground station, which is no use to me. I can't use it. But then if I go down the road, I can use the tube, but I can only, it will only take me to, I can only get off at stations that are accessible. So unless that gives me like maybe two or three places in London that I can go to. Right. And then otherwise I would have to take a cab, which is what I do, but it's very expensive. It's like so expensive to be disabled if you want to leave the house. It's just like crazy, just money pouring out of every orifice as soon as you wheel outside.
Anybody doing in a cab, it's gonna make that cab ride a lot more expensive for sure.
But like to that point about the expenses too, I mean, like it's more expensive for taking cabs. You mentioned like having a carer come and help to do mm-hmm. like washing and things like that. I don't know. What are your thoughts on the expenses of being a disabled person?
I was thinking about this the other day, actually, I guess in light of the tax return 31st of Jan deadline. And I was thinking like, I don't know, I meant to Google to see what tax actually goes on, because I was thinking like, I can't really use like public transport really. I also like the NHS, if I want to see a doctor for my illness, I probably have to go private unless I'm willing to wait a year. I was sort of thinking like, what am I actually paying for? Like, it would be great if there was just a little discount that you could get if you're disabled. And obviously there are disability benefits. And I'm very fortunate that I work full time. So that means that I don't qualify for most of them, which is fine. But I get 20 Great British Pounds a week disability benefit, to be fully transparent. And that doesn't cover anything, actually, really. It's like a tiny, weeny little drop in the ocean. And of course, I will take it. I mean, but yeah, I think, I don't know. I think it's not a fair system as it stands, but I think the UK and probably like the rest of the world are so stretched at the moment. I'm just like very happy that I can work and I can kind of live a life that I don't know. Yeah, I think, yeah, it's not really fair. I think I should be more compensated for the money that I have to spend.
Definitely.
Yeah, I think it's just not realistic.
Just for context for folks, we were talking about the Smoove earlier and, you know, you mentioning like the costs associated. Bri, how much do you think the Smoove costs? There's two models. You've got the 4 miles per hour Smoove and the sport model, which is the 6 miles per hour Smoove.
Oh, fuck.
Look out.
I feel like I have a pretty good gauge for
US
this
dollars.
Type of tax.
Let's go USD.
So let's say the base model, $3,500 US, and let's say the pro model, $5,000 USD.
Let's try 4 miles per hour is $6,895 US.
Whoa.
And Canadian dollars, that's significantly more expensive. And the 6 mile per hour, the step up is an extra $100. So if you're not getting the 6 mile per hour,
you might as well get the six.
Yeah,
mile
you're doing yourself a disservice. But yeah, I mean, like, you know, that's a lot, right? And
yeah.
And so of course there is health insurance that might cover those costs. But like again, if let's say you're an artist or you know you're someone who doesn't have health insurance, that's a lot of money out of pocket.
I like your idea, Isabel, about getting some sort of tax breaks because you're right. Like you don't use the same amount of services that you know the quote unquote general able-bodied person would, and that makes a lot of sense to me.
Yeah,
I mean,
let's do it.
Yeah, fuck yeah.
Hey, I'll tell you, here in Canada, like I mean, and our system isn't perfect by any means, and there's a lot of improvement that needs to happen, but there's. You know, there's a disability tax credit here that I'm very grateful for. And so, you know, to see that being implemented in more places across the world, I think it would be very, you know, very vital and very important. Isabel, I would love to ask you a question that we ask most of our guests. What would you say is the biggest thing that your experience with CFS and POTS has taken away from you?
I would say freedom, like, and spontaneity, whichever is applicable. I think, yeah, it's literally like I have totally, don't get me wrong, I have gained certain things that I'm like, I wouldn't have, like, outlooks and things that I wouldn't have ever found a way to had I not have had the experiences that I've had. But I think the freedom, like I can't just be like, oh, let's go. Like if I won the lottery tomorrow, what could I actually do? Like I couldn't just jet off and like go on a round the world adventure. I couldn't you know, obviously I'd buy a nice house and things, but like in terms of like, I think you just, you can't put a price on health, I guess, at the end of the day. And I think, the freedom to just like go with the flow or like decide that you want to do something and you're going to do it. I just don't have that. And that's fine. I have lots of other great things, but I think that's probably like what I miss the most, like freedom and peak physical fitness.
What would you say is the biggest thing that it's given you?
I think it's definitely like, I mean, it doesn't sound like it would have, but it has like fed quite an optimistic outlook. And I think I'm very grateful for what I do have. I think it's put a lot of things in perspective. And even when I recovered after, like, even when I recovered sort of in my 20s after the bedridden chapter, I really felt a lot of appreciation. But that did begin to wear off, I think. And then more recently, it sort of like refreshed things as well, because I remember when I first sort of was released from my bedridden chapter, just thinking like, oh my God, I've got no walls around me. Wow. Like just being like blown away by like everything. And I think that does wear off just day to day, the grind and stuff. But I think more recently now I like just really appreciate tiny things. Like I went to the opticians yesterday and I was like, oh, it's great to be out. I just think like it does put things in perspective. And I think especially like going out in a wheelchair, whereas like when I was sort of, yeah, maybe in my 20s, maybe I'd be worried about looking fat. Whereas now I'm worried about like, is this place going to have a ramp? I think it's like definitely like brought me back down to earth. And I don't think I really needed it because I think it's okay to worry about like, you know, superficial things. I think that's fine. But it has definitely like realigned my worries. And now I think I'm just like, yeah, it's put things in perspective.
Well, I got to say, Isabel, like you, at least in this conversation, it really does feel like you've embraced your disability as a part of your identity. And I think that that's one of those things that a lot of people struggle with. And I think that what, you know, that is a quality that is vitally important for people who are out there trying to create change and trying to spread awareness. And it's just so nice to see someone like yourself who is in that position, who really is like playing a role in changing the way that we view disability. And I commend you for that. This has been just an absolutely delightful conversation. And we really appreciate you taking your time to sit down and chat with us. Thank you so much.
Well, thank you for having me.
For more CBC podcasts, go to cbc.ca/podcasts.